Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you're the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
Hi everyone, I'm here to tell you about LA Not So Confidential, the forensic psychology and true crime podcast brought to you by me, Dr. Shiloh, and this guy.
Hi, I'm her bestie and co-host, Dr. Scott. She was a cop and I was a Hollywood casting director. Now we're both forensic psychologists working in Los Angeles. We met while doing our internships working with sex offenders. I know, right?
Twice a month, we bring you a classic or contemporary true crime story while applying real psychological concepts and dishing about entertainment's representations of those crimes.
Subscribe now to LA
Not So
Confidential wherever you get your podcasts.
True crime, psychology, and snark.
Trust us, we're doctors.
Hey, Jen.
How are you?
You startled me.
I'm sorry. You were deep in thought.
I was. What's up, girl? What's up?
Nothing.
What's up?
We are, this is our first episode after our first year anniversary.
First year anniversary. I wonder what the first year anniversary is
for. Paper.
It's probably new recording equipment because we can't. Or, well, we already had an editor because that was our 6 month podcast.
That was our third month. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Just wanted to let the good folks know that since we've already hit our 1 year anniversary after this episode, we are going to be taking off for a few weeks. We shall be back on August 2nd.
And then I will commence my state of mourning as I know school is about to start that
next week. Our school goes back the 15th. It's amazing.
We go back really early this year.
Yeah. So
I'm really happy about it.
We will keep recording. We'll probably still be doing Patreon episodes and such and whatnot and fun things.
And we're getting out the Patreon episode, which was 2 weeks ago. So you should already have it, people.
Right. Exactly. So with that, real quickly, I want to mention that we have had some very nice comments on Facebook and Twitter reviews. And
yay.
I just want to state their names real quickly, okay?
Yes, please.
Maureen, thank you very much. Ashley Van, Zoe the Ho 4. Actually, great name. Thank you very much. Jess M, Shelby C, Gail P, Randy S, Michelle M, and Pam S. Thank you very, very much for your kind, super kind comments.
Thank you.
We appreciate it very much. It makes our
mucho apreciado
day. And we do have two new Patreon members. Actually, four new Patreon members. Holy cow. We have Bender, True Crime Nana, Christy, and Michelle.
Yay.
Thank you guys.
Thank
we
you guys.
Really appreciate it. We're getting stuff out to you in the mail today. And also, we want to give a huge thanks to David W. and the Gray-Faced Mafia. They donated. They did a one-time donation via our webpage. So thank you very much. And we hope Diesel, Ernie, and Sienna love to listen to our podcast.
I bet they do.
I bet you they do, too.
All the cool dogs, too.
Oh, of course. Of course they do.
Of course.
So anyway, if he is Dog Dad on Twitter and you can see the faces of those beautiful pups online, he posts them all the time and it always makes me happy. So anyway, thank you to all of you. We love you totally. Think you rock and you're awesome.
Thank you. Yeah.
You're super excited.
No,
we really do appreciate you.
I know. I'm excited.
You make it worthwhile.
All right. Oops. Well, I got a little story here for you.
You do?
Ready to hear it?
Yeah.
Okay. You ready?
Actually, we'll probably be back August 7th. We don't know.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. Stay tuned. Okay. You got a case for us today?
I do. You ready?
Yep. Let me hear it.
Newton, Kansas sits in America's heartland with fields of wheat, cornfields, as far as the eye can see. The small town of about 19,000 is big on family and God, and rarely does anybody in town lock their doors.
Mm-hmm.
They all know each other, and many have grown up and grown old, having never left their hometown.
We know places like that.
Which is often the case
in
small towns. It's a very trusting community with a long line of families, raising families. But that trust was shattered in the spring of 1994.
Completely shattered or just kind of like
I'd say broke. Completely shattered.
Completely shattered.
Friday, May 20th, 1994, it's a bit after 3 in the afternoon, when Mother Ann McNeil arrives at Rhonda Clable's house to pick up her daughter Gwen, who had a play date with Rhonda's daughter, Natalie. Ann knocks on the door, rings the doorbell, but no one answers. Ann thinks that maybe they went shopping, so she heads home. Now, once she gets home, Ann calls the house again and again, and no one's answering.
Oh, that's scary.
It's very scary. The kids are little itty-bitties. Ann begins to panic as she knows that Rhonda would not be gone for a long period of time and not tell her since she had her daughter. Ann calls Rhonda's husband, who then calls a cousin that lived nearby, and his name's Henry Cavanaugh. So the husband sends Henry Cavanaugh over to Rhonda's house to check in. Cavanaugh shows up, he has a key, and he lets himself in. He calls out for Rhonda, and no one responds. He notices Rhonda's purse on the counter, and he empties it. As he's making his way through the house, he hears a muffled call for help. He tries to figure out where it's coming from, and he makes his way to the closet and opens it. And inside are two very frightened little girls.
Oh,
Natalie,
babies.
Age 5, can only say that a bad man came inside and he got mommy.
Oh, that's awful. Poor little girls.
Cavanaugh calls 911, who then tell him to take the girls and get out of the house immediately and wait for them outside.
Right.
He rushes outside with the girls and waits for help to arrive. About 20 minutes later, Detective Walton arrives on the scene as the police had already came to the house and had gotten there just a few minutes before. As Detective Walton approaches the front door, he can tell something very bad has occurred inside the home. Walton makes his way down the hall to the last bedroom, peeks inside, and on the bed is the lifeless body of Rhonda Clable. The scene was gruesome. Rhonda had had her hands and feet tied up and bound behind her using pantyhose. Her hair was matted with blood, and one of her eyes had been injured and was swollen shut. As the detective got closer, he could see a sock was covering her mouth and masking tape over that. On the ground, he found a pair of aviator sunglasses. Her body was lying on the bed and looked as if there was a struggle of sorts. There was blood splatters on the wall, nearby picture frames, and all over the bed. County prosecutor Mary McDonald arrives and immediately notes what kind of killer would do this. It had to be a person who was not afraid of being caught or seen since it was during the daytime. He was bold in doing it, especially with the two little girls in the house. Had he done this before, or did Rhonda know the person? Authorities are not yet sure, but they need to figure it out, and they need to figure it out fast. Detective Walton makes his way outside to look around and see if he can find anything. Immediately, he notices several discarded cigarette butts outside underneath a window. It's a big picture window that would look in into the living room, I guess.
Kind of what we have in the back of the house.
Yeah. Knowing that Rhonda, nor no one in her family, smoke, he assumes that these may just belong to the killer. Now, it's 1994, as I stated earlier.
Right.
DNA was just coming onto the scene.
Mm-hmm.
So while that option is out for right now, police hope that they can maybe pull a print off the cigarette butts.
Yeah, you would think that they could.
Detective Walton knows he needs to talk to the young girls and, you know, kind of question them, but oh so delicately, since they're so little, about what they saw and to learn anything about the man who was responsible for this vicious crime.
And that's if they can even remember it properly.
They did a great job.
Did they?
They did.
Good.
The girls tell him that they were sitting in the kitchen eating ice cream that Rhonda had just made them. The doorbell rang, and Rhonda left the kitchen to answer the door, only to return with this man alongside her. The girl said that they had never seen the man before. They didn't know him, but that he had very long, dark hair under a red baseball cap, and he was very tall, which I was kind of thinking about little kids, because little kids think everybody's tall.
Right, exactly.
They said that Rhonda was acting strange as she told them to finish their ice cream and that she needed to go into the other room with this man.
Hmm.
The mom told them that when they were finished with their ice cream to go play quietly in Natalie's room. That's her daughter, which they did because they're cute little girls. The girls went in Natalie's room and they began playing. And as we all know, kids get bored pretty easy, especially at that age. So Natalie decides to go check in on her mom because she wants to go outside with Gwen and they want permission to go outside and play. So Natalie goes down to her mom's bedroom. As Natalie makes her way down the hallway, she runs into the strange man who was not with her mom at this time. He had stepped out of the bedroom. Natalie runs past him and into the bedroom where she sees her mother all tied up. The shock is soon broken as she feels this man grab her from behind. Mm. This is a little girl. And place her and Gwen inside the closet in Natalie's room. Moments later, the girls would hear what they believed to be gunshots ring out. Panicked and in sheer terror, the girls would remain in the closet until Henry Cavanaugh, who's the cousin, would hear them and free them.
I don't think I'd move either. That's terrifying.
Now, normally, one of the first suspects, as we know, would be who?
The husband.
Of course, the husband. But the husband was actually working 30 miles away.
Right.
Plus the little girls would know. So they had already stated that they weren't able to identify this man. Rhonda's husband, Vaughn, arrived home to find police all over and two scared little girls waiting with an officer on the front lawn. He is informed of what happened, and knowing that the little girl's eyes were all on him to see how he would react, he tried to really remain strong and not freak out and keep his composure. He attempts to answer some questions the police have, including if those aviator sunglasses that they found on the bedroom floor were his. He responded, no, they're not his. So police believe these glasses were left by accident.
By the killer. Nice deduction.
Thanks. Police continue to investigate, and they begin going door to door in the neighborhood to see if anybody saw anything, if anybody knows of anything. Sadly, neighbors cannot provide any new details of this stranger that was in the area. The medical examiner report soon comes in, and it shows that Rhonda was not sexually assaulted.
Hmm.
Police believe that what had happened is that he had planned to commit an assault on her, but due to the distractions, possibly, or maybe that he was unable to perform with the little girls nearby, with the doorbell ringing, with the phone ringing, that something happened and he couldn't do it.
Were they even sure that it was sexually motivated?
No, they're guessing at this point because she wasn't and she was tied up. The report also revealed that Rhonda was struck in the head so aggressively, 13 times to be exact. And what the girls thought were gunshots when they were in the closet, this broke my heart, were actually Rhonda's skull cracking with each hit. That's how hard and loud it was.
The man hates her.
The murder weapon was a large and heavy tool, something like a mallet, they're thinking, and realizing that obviously what you just said, he's very, very angry.
Angry, yeah. Because that's overkill. I mean,
due to the material that he used to hold her, the socks in the mouth and the pantyhose, no prints could be lifted off of them because of the fibrous materials. The cigarette butts also would offer nothing. Investigators had one thing left, the sunglasses. Police would use a tool that was rather new at that time called super glue fuming. We've talked about it. The way it's done, the super glue is heated up and then it is kind of covered up with sort of like a dome or whatever. And as the glue heats up, it adheres to the item.
The fume.
Often leaving a print. This time, there were no prints found on the sunglasses. The only piece of evidence would end up revealing nothing. So police decide that they need to start all over. They need to rethink this. They go back and review everything once again and see if they've missed something, starting with Henry Cavanaugh's story. After looking at it and thinking about it, police start to see maybe a few holes in his original story that he had given police. They wonder why Cavanaugh would go inside her house, directly see her purse, and empty it. Sort of a strange thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, if you went over to check on your cousin, you're not necessarily going to empty out their purse.
No, but if nobody could get a hold of her and...
It's true.
You know, and her purse is there. Did she leave her keys somewhere or is her keys in the purse? I don't know a lot of men that would go through a woman's purse, though.
Also, Kavanaugh was a nursing student, so why wouldn't he go in and see if he could help her? Why would he immediately get the girls, call 911 without checking on her? Because after he called 911, they told him to go outside, which to me would make sense.
Right.
But the police were starting to wonder, you know, most right. people would continue on through the house, and he didn't.
Well, it's smart. They could have contaminated the entire crime
scene. Or the guy could still be there.
Exactly.
Things aren't adding up quite right. Police are starting to think. So they ask him if he would be willing to come in for a polygraph exam. He says, of course. Henry Kavanaugh agrees, and he comes in and takes the exam. And what he would say would leave some detectives scratching their head, to say the least. When asked why he didn't go into the bedroom and help his cousin Rhonda, Kavanaugh said it was an angel that stopped him from opening that bedroom door.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Now, while that's not that odd in that situation, and I get that, it's the next part.
Well, they are a religious community, but still, yeah.
It's this next part that would place him at the top of the old suspect list. What do you think of your cousin Rhonda? And he answered with one simple word, sexy. Police then ask if he killed her. And Kavanaugh said, if he had killed her, he must have blacked out. Now, police
not even denying it. He just said,
nope.
Holy cow.
Police are even more interested in Henry Kavanaugh at this point. But there's one thing that doesn't
add up.
And that's Natalie, the little girl, would have definitely been able to recognize her relative, right? Even if he was in a disguise, his voice, because he talked to him. You know, he made a couple statements to them. And as we all know, being a weirdo doesn't make you a killer necessarily.
Correct. Or being in love with your cousin.
Or being whatever floats your boat.
Exactly.
Henry Kavanaugh, lawyers up, and for now is off limits to investigators.
That's probably smart.
Detective Walton is okay with that, as he just doesn't believe Kavanaugh is the guy. He knows that something's not right, but he just doesn't truly believe that he is capable of this. So now they have no one.
No suspects.
At this point, they have really no one that's at the top of their list, and they're all confused as to what's going to happen now. In the meantime, police work hard and try to keep the story in the papers out there for people to see. They try to keep it in the press, running stories on it. Little ones, big ones, it didn't matter. They just wanted it out there.
It's teeny ones?
Yep. They were hoping somebody would see it and then
come forward.
Yeah. Or, you know, somebody would talk.
Yeah. Yes.
So, just as they had hoped, let's talk about how things, you know, we talk about things line up.
Mm-hmm.
Just the stars line. So, Lois Gibson is in Newton visiting family and just happens to pick up the newspaper and see what's going on. Now, she was raised in Newton, right?
But right.
Was living somewhere
yeah,
else.
I do that.
Back to visit.
When I go to my dad's
nosy.
House,
you just want to see what's going on, right?
See if there's anybody in the paper that I know.
So, she picks up the newspaper and she sees the story in the paper of the murder. She is shocked knowing that Newton does not have crime like this ever, not like the city she lives in now.
Mm-hmm.
Lois continues to read the article, interested to see who was responsible for this crime, because obviously, you know, there has to be an ending to it. And when she reaches the end, she's left in disbelief. How could this murder not yet be solved? The murder is still unsolved, which means there is a man out there roaming the streets scot-free, a man with a face that two little girls got a good look at when he was in their house killing the one little girl's mother. A man who may be apprehended if only a good sketch was developed of him and circulated around. Did I mention that Lois is from Houston, Texas?
Oh, nice.
And she works for the Houston Police Department.
Oh, good, Lois.
As a forensic sketch artist.
Oh, perfect.
Didn't see that coming, did you?
No.
She also has been responsible for helping put nearly 800 people behind bars at this time.
Oh, awesome. What's her name? Lois?
Lois Gibson.
Gibson. Yay, Lois Gibson. I need a hero.
And she's it, baby. Well,
good for her.
Lois Gibson picks up the phone and calls authorities. Picks up authorities and tells them that what she does and that she's there. And the police are like, yeah, but you travel on vacation with your sketch gear? Yeah, she does. So she scheduled the very next day to come into the station and meet with a now 6-year-old Natalie, who will help her come up with the sketch, but will also be having to relive that god-awful day, right? So little Natalie is given what is called an FBI sketchbook that features parts of faces.
Mm-hmm.
So like eyes. So there's like 250 sets of eyes, 250 right. sets of noses, all that stuff. And so she needs to look through it and be picking out facial features like the man she saw that terrible day. Gibson begins her work from the top of the head with the hair and the hairline and works her way down to the chin and the jawbone and all that. She's very careful to ask Natalie questions and reminds her that if she doesn't know the answer, that's fine. She doesn't need to say it. And if she can't describe them, that's fine too. They right. can kind of just
no pressure.
Talk about it.
Right.
But Natalie knows, and she is not afraid to describe this demon. From his piercing blue eyes to his long, dark, shaggy hair, she's certain about his looks. When Lois finished the sketch, she was looking directly at the face of the killer. The sketch is so good. We'll put it on the blog. It really is like for a little girl to be able to do this. And during the part that I read of her, that she was saying that like adults second guess themselves. So usually children are much like they just
more pure.
They don't think
they
about it. So it's like he had these color eyes and he had this and his hair was this long and it's just that, you know. Police are now excited and they think they'll be able to solve this horrid crime with this sketch. The sketch is put out everywhere. Tips are coming in, but nothing seems to be panning out. The excitement fades as a year passes and frustration is felt all over town until a phone call comes in on September 23rd from nearby Wichita. Wichita police have called Detective Walton seeking help with a missing persons case. Jonetta McCowan was in her 30s, a petite, pretty blonde who was working as a prostitute. McCowan and her friend Emma were walking the street, you know, working the street.
You mean a sex worker?
I mean a sex worker, I'm sorry. When a man approached the women, he offered $200 for McCowan.
Wow.
He wanted her to come and stay the night with him. McCowan's friend Emma pleaded with her not to go. She said that this guy gave her the creeps, like something was just not right.
Always follow your gut.
McGowan assured her she'll be okay, and she went with the man. The man had bugged Emma, her friend, so badly that when McGowan got into the car, she wrote down his license plate, just in case. When Jonetta does not show up to meet Emma, her friend, the following day, Emma calls police to report her missing. Police ask her about the man, and Emma says she didn't get a good look at him. But she wrote down his tag number. Police run the tag number and it comes back to a man named Chester Higginbotham, who just happened to live in Newton. Police go to his address and, you know, they have just a few questions for him and about the whereabouts of the young girl that had disappeared the very night before. As they're on the scene, they arrive there and he's not home. So they're kind of just mulling about his, you know, kind of nosing around a little bit. And Chester and his wife, Jenna, pull up. Chester gets out to see what's going on. And police tell them that they have a warrant to search his house, and he needs to come down to the station. Chester agrees, and he is getting loaded up into the patrol car by another officer as Detective Walton stays behind to help in the search. They search his house, and they even search his car, but they find no signs of Jenetta. They come up empty-handed. Walton heads down to the station. He wants to get a crack at interviewing Chester. Chester admits that he did pick up Jonetta, but after they were finished, quote unquote, he dropped her off at the bus station in Wichita. Police believe this to be untrue, as Jonetta's friend said that she would not be going anywhere. This was her home. She didn't have any friends or family anywhere else.
Right.
Why would she be going anywhere? In the bus station, it had closed prior to him even picking her up on that street corner.
Really?
So he was caught in his first lie. Police uncover his long rap sheet of petty crimes and thefts. In the early 1990s, Chester moved to Newton, so the police decide to call in his wife, Jenna, to fill in a few blanks or maybe get some more information on him. Jenna tells officers that she was working in a gas station when Chester would come in, get sodas and drinks and snacks, and she says his smile just did it for her.
Ugh.
The two started dating, and within 6 months, Chester popped the question. The two married, and Jenna says at first it was all good, very in love. But soon, Jenna discovered an ugly side to her groom. He liked to drink. A lot. And then he would often get angry. A lot. Jenna was the meek sort. She wouldn't really say a word back to him, and he knew that. I think that's why he picked her. At this time, police told her, while Chester was being questioned, and through tears and disbelief, Jenna had a story for them. Jenna recounts to them that two nights prior, Chester had went out with a friend. She was expecting him back around 10:30, 11 o'clock that night. She says that time came and went, and she was starting to worry about him, and maybe something had happened to him. So she started thinking about where he might be. So she got in the car and she drove down to a storage shed that he had rented out and would keep cars there that he'd work on and things like that. She states that she pulled in and he came rushing out to greet her. As they were talking, Jenna could see a person, a blonde female, in the front seat of his car. She asked Chester about it, and he said, it's a friend of a friend. She needed a ride. She drank too much. I said I'd take her home. Then Chester said, he'll be dropping her off, and then he will be straight home. Jenna began to get scared, as she noticed the girl in the car had not moved the entire time she was there. Didn't look at her. Then she said, in fact, it seemed like she was more slumped in the car, not seated.
Oh.
Jenna left without asking questions. Chester came home about 15 minutes later, and the two went to bed, never to discuss it.
Really?
Takes me back to her being meek, and that's why he picked her.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I would have been like, who is that?
Who is that? What is she in my...
Yanking that door open?
I know. What are you doing? I'd be talking to her.
But if you suspect something that you maybe not really want to know the answer to...
I guess. I want to know the answer to everything. I'm too nosy not to.
Thank you. Police get a search warrant for the storage shed. They make their way into it, and they're hoping to find Janetta, but she's not in the shed. There are a few interesting items in there, so they take them. If you found these in the back of the car, you'd think maybe it was a rape kit.
Mm.
It was a nylon rope, duct tape, zip ties.
Yep.
But in a storage shed, you know, maybe that's just where you keep them. I'm trying to think positive here. Think positive. The police took the items into custody, and they arrested Chester for hiring a...
sex worker,
because they had wanted him in custody.
Right.
They wanted to buy some time and try to
get... They knew he was guilty of something, but yes, they didn't have anything to arrest him on but that.
A month after Janetta's disappearance, a county maintenance worker discovers a heavily decayed body on the side of the road. Now, it's hard to make out the body because it had decomposed so much. But what was not hard to see was that this person had her ankles and wrist hogtied behind her, and the cord used to tie her, a nylon cord just like the one the police found in Chester's storage shed. The position of her body brought back memories of exactly how Rhonda was tied up that summer afternoon in her house.
Right.
Police realize at this point that Chester Higginbotham looks a lot like that sketch that was developed in the murder of Rhonda, who was slaughtered just 16 months earlier. Due to the decomposition of her body, they can't find enough evidence to link Chester to her death. They do know he picked her up that night before, and they do know that she disappeared after that. They do know that Jenna had seen a blonde female in the car, but as we know, sadly, that's not enough to file murder charges. Police can't hold him much longer, and they need to tie the two deaths, hopefully, or at least one, because they are positive he's responsible for Janetta's, if not also Rhonda's. Detective Walton comes up with a plan. He decides he's going to call in Chester's wife, Jenna, to the police station under the guise of working out just a few more details about that night that Jenna went to see him at the shed. Walton begins by telling her that her husband is now the suspect in not only Janetta's murder, but another one. Walton then asks, what brand cigarettes did Chester smoke?
Ooh.
And guess what?
Same.
It's the same kind that was found outside the window of Rhonda's home.
Wow.
Strike one.
Exactly.
Detective Walton then asks if Chester wears sunglasses, and if so, what kind? Jenna says, well, yeah, he does, and he prefers aviator shades.
At night.
Strike two. Detective Walton knows that he is the right guy beyond a shadow of a doubt, and he knows he needs to get him soon because he's going to do it again and again and again if he hasn't already and they just don't know it. The pressure's on. Now, I know we've both talked about karma and how there are few coincidences in life. I mean, I believe that. I think you do too. We've talked about that.
What goes around comes around.
I believe often things cross our paths or come into our lives right when we need them. And well, just like magic, Detective Walton goes to work on Monday and hears that a class is being taught on trace evidence.
Ooh.
Hmm.
You mean like Steve?
Mm-hmm.
Our friend Steve's podcast?
It is.
Trace evidence?
They're doing a whole new podcast in 1994 called Trace Evidence, starring Steve, but he doesn't even know it yet.
He doesn't.
Walton attends that class and hears that technology has now advanced and even the smallest amounts of DNA can now be tested.
See,
technology's catching up.
Always.
The sunglasses pop in his head immediately, but he wonders if they can still be tested since they were encrusted with the glue that had adhered to them. He figures he has nothing left to lose.
Exactly. So don't take a chance. You don't stand a chance.
He talks to the instructor. Instructor says, exactly. Mm-hmm. Might as well try it. So he sends the sunglasses off and a blood sample with it to the lab.
A blood sample of Chester's?
Mm-hmm. It will be months before the results come back. As Detective Walton waits, he decided to take a deeper look into Chester's past to see, you know, just where he was when Rhonda was murdered.
Right.
You know, was he in the area? Who knows? Any connection? Who knows? Huh. Detective Walton learned that at the time, Jenna was not in the picture yet. They weren't married yet. And that Chester lived only two blocks from Rhonda's house.
Wow.
Hmm. And in fact, Chester walked to work every day that he worked at a nearby restaurant. He was a waiter, waiting tables there.
Did he walk past?
And on his walk, he would pass by her house each and every day.
Somebody developed a crush.
Police go to the restaurant to see if anybody there remembers Chester. Detective Walton is surprised to hear that a coworker who worked with Chester still works here. And in fact, he's working right now. He's back in the kitchen. Detective Walton goes back there and was like, huh. So, you know, I'm here to find out about this guy named Chester. The co-worker of Chester's tells Detective Walton that one day Rhonda was in eating with some of the ladies from church.
Mm-hmm.
He remembered this because in a small town, these things, they would pop in your head, right? She had asked to talk to a manager about a discrepancy on her bill, but the manager just stepped out. The waiter came to the table to discuss the matter, and the chat soon became quite heated. And the waiter would turn out to be none other than
Chester
Higginbotham. The man said he remembered this incident very clearly because Chester returned to the kitchen shouting about what a bitch that woman was. Within a week, that same woman was viciously killed, making it very easy for him to recall that his coworker, all of that had taken place.
Right. That would stick out in your mind. I would remember that.
Could not forget. The lab results are now back in from the Wichita police in regards to the Jeanetta case. The duct tape found on Jeanetta's mouth is from the same roll of duct tape that was found in the storage shed and taken by police. The end of it was raggedy.
Right.
The nylon cord used to hog tie her matched the same nylon cord that was located and taken from the shed by police. Police now have enough evidence to charge him with the murder of Jeanetta. They're ecstatic that he'll be going away for killing her, but they're still not satisfied with the Rhonda murder.
Correct.
But just like how some things fall into place, the lab calls Detective Walton, and they inform him that they were able to find some DNA on those aviator sunglasses.
Good.
And it is the DNA of Chester Higginbotham, proving that he was in Rhonda's bedroom that day.
Right.
And there's no way that they knew each other or how he would be in there. It has been almost 2 years since her death, but police are now able to piece together what they think happened that day. The doorbell rings, Rhonda answers the door, and is immediately overtaken by this strange man. Rhonda, fearful for her children and child's friend, complies with him, doesn't give up much of a struggle. He ushers her into the bedroom, but is interrupted by Natalie coming in there.
Because she wants to go outside to play.
She wants to go outside and play. They also believe at this time, possibly the doorbell was ringing from Anne, who is Gwen's mom, the friend, and then the phone calls, all of that was taking place. So all of this was stopping him, maybe getting him a little scared.
He needed Calgon to take him away.
He did. Panicked, he knows he needs to get out of there. So he throws the little girls in the closet and he returns to the bedroom. Chester knows that Rhonda will be able to identify him. So he knows he has to kill her and makes his escape. But he failed to, I guess he was too, I don't know, like he couldn't bring himself to kill the small girls. Thank God, really. So that's what they believe happened. They believe that he
went there because he was so mad about the argument that he went in there to kill her.
Yeah, and he just got angry. Which, again, and then he did it to the sex worker. So Chester Higginbotham was eventually charged with and convicted of first-degree premeditated murder in Jeanetta's death. The body had been decomposed so badly that they weren't quite sure how she died.
Mm-hmm.
but they had determined it was most likely asphyxiation, as nothing else could be determined from that, and that the duct tape was placed over her nose and mouth, causing her to suffocate.
Yeah, that happens.
He was charged with first-degree premeditated murder and hurt death. Then he was charged with 40 years of kidnapping for Rhonda and 40 years of murder. Is that what I said?
40 years for murder and 40 for kidnapping. How is it considered kidnapping? Because he tied her up? Technically, she didn't leave her house.
I mean, he took her. I mean, basically, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
I don't know.
Weird. We'll have to look into that.
Yeah, we will.
And if anybody else that's listening to it has an answer to that, let us know.
Well, here, I guess, now that you brought all that up, Jen, I can go back on here and look at the end and see what he got for that. Hold on. He was ultimately charged with premeditated first-degree murder in the death of Rhonda Klebold. Prior to trial, the state filed a motion to introduce evidence of the defendant's conviction for the other and was granted the motion and ruled that the evidence would be admissible. All right, that's all I got, Jen.
Yeah, very interesting case. Is he still in prison? Do you know if he's still alive or anything
like
that? I
believe he is still in prison. In 2001, he tried to get his case appealed.
Mm-hmm.
And
no such luck?
No.
Good.
See you, bye-bye.
Yeah, I wonder if his wife stuck by him.
No, they're divorced,
oh,
by
good.
The way. Yeah.
Good for her.
I mean, you would hope.
Well, you never know. If she's really as meek as everybody says.
Yeah.
She might have stayed around. What Low self-esteem.
Yeah, totally.
Sad. Very sad. All right.
All right. You want to tell good people where they can find us?
Sure. You can find us on Twitter at Our True Crime Podcast. We have a discussion page on Facebook and a regular page, which is Our True Crime Podcast or Our True Crime Podcast discussion page. It's fancy. You can email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. We do have a blog, ourtruecrimepodcast.com. And on that, there is links to our Etsy store for logoed merch. There is also a link to a one-time donation, and there should be a link to our Patreon. If you feel the need that you want to help us out financially, that's fine.
If not,
that's fine too. We appreciate everyone and glad you're listening.
We are glad you're listening.
We are. We really are. Keep leaving us all those nice comments. It really makes our day. You have no idea how happy we are when we get new comments. When the comments are not nice.
I don't even want to talk about that one. I don't even want to talk about it right now.
Yeah, well, whatever. Anyway, if you can't be nice, don't say anything.
I just don't get it. I really don't get it.
It's their job.
They think it is their job.
The last one that we...
If you can't be nice, I mean, that's just old.
I know. The very last bad review that we received, I checked all their other bad reviews.
Is that what they do for a living?
All their other reviews, and all of them were bad.
What do you think you're doing?
Never reviewed
what
anybody
nicely. What do you think
nicely.
You're doing?
Solving the world.
No.
Solving problems of the world. One
so annoying.
Opinion at a time. I don't know. They suck.
Whatever.
Also remember that we are taking a two-week break, and we will be back on the first Wednesday in August.
Okay. Remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya. See ya soon.
Klebold.
Mm.
Klebold.
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 Klebold. Klebold. Klebold. I made you out of clay. See?
Wichita police have called Detective Watson. Nope. Because that's Sherlock's buddy.
It is.
I'm going to reach over to Tim right now. I'm going to punch him right now. I'm going to punch him.
I didn't do anything.
I'm doing this. Detective Walton knows that he is the right guy beyond Detective Walton.
Yeah.
Shut up. Oops. Sorry.
All right.
I had an itch. Sorry.
Don't itch your crotch here.
Stop it. It was my arm. You're cute, though.
First, I was afraid. I was petrified. I kept thinking I could never live without you by my side. And then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong, that I grew strong. And I learned how to get along, and so you're back from outer space. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. Should have changed that stupid lock. I should have made you leave the key. If I'd have known for just 1 second, you'd be back to bother me. Oh, now go.
God, look at you go.
Walk out the door. Don't hang around now. You're not welcome anymore. Weren't you the one who used to hurt me with goodbye? You think I crumbled? You think I'd lay down and die? No, no, not I. I will survive. Oh, as long as I know how to love, I know I'll stay alive. I've got all my love to live.
Can you pause that?
I've got all my love to give, but I'll survive.
I know you want him to hear
it. I will survive.
Don't you?
Hey, hey.